All rise. The Honorable Chief Justice and Justices of the Supreme Court of Ohio. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio is now in open session pursuant to adjournment.
Good morning. Be seated, please. Justice Stratton is here. She will be in a moment. I'd like to begin by thanking those who invited us to come to Seneca County. David Schein from North Central Ohio Educational Service Center gave us the extended the original invitation. The planning committee was composed of David Schein, Judge Michael Kelbley, in whose courtroom we are sitting, whose courtroom we have disrupted for at least a day. Randall Schwartz, the Bar Association president. I understand the bench, this wonderful bench, was built by Verlin Thacker, Tom Thacker, and Larry Eberhardt. This is the 35th visit the Supreme Court has made to a county outside Franklin County, and there will be about 22,000 students who have had this experience. For the sake of the students, what you will see and hear from this point is what you would see and hear if you were to view these cases argued in our courtroom in Columbus. The first case is Verlin Wagner, 96-2730, Verlin Wagner versus Northwestern Indemnity Company. Mr. Fitzgerald.
May it please this court and the honored guest of this court. Judge, at the outset, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes of rebuttal time. The named insured in this case is Verlin Wagner, but for all intents and purposes, I'll be referring to him as Tony Wagner in this argument. 6.5 years ago, on August 27, 1991, Tony and Ruth Wagner's IGA store caught on fire in Seneca County and destroyed the contents and effectively put them out of business. At the time, the fire was of an unknown cause. Midwestern Insurance Company came on site, completed a physical investigation, and 5 days after the fire, they told Tony to clean up the fire site. A month later, Midwestern had an origin report that said the fire was probably incendiary, and I will note that Tony never received that report until a lawsuit was filed. In that report, there was no source of the fire, there was no identification of any accelerants, no person was ever identified, and there was no investigation whatsoever that was consistent with Tony's innocence. No investigation whatsoever that was consistent with Tony's innocence.
Counsel, the Court of Appeals said go back and retry this case because a different standard applies today. You argue that that's a lower standard.
Your Honor,
different words. Is it indeed a lower standard?
Your Honor, we had the burden of proof. We had to prove that Midwestern acted with actual intent applying the Said standard. And that was the law at the time we tried the case. And then in September of 1994, this court promulgated the Zoppo standard that said the insurance company you have to prove that they acted without reasonable justification. We had the burden. We always have the burden. Even on a remand, we would have the burden. And our point is that by trying it on a higher standard, Midwestern cannot claim prejudice. And I'll be prepared to address that fully now if we can get by the facts.
Did Zoppo overrule Said?
Only as it relates to the actual intent.
Did it specifically overrule Said?
It said Said is still the law of the state of Ohio except for the deletion of the actual intent requirement.
When that happens, this court overrules a prior case, what is the effect of the prior case?
Your Honor, the Court of Appeals felt that we had to adhere to the Peerless standard in the state of Ohio. And the Peerless says that if you overrule bad law, it never was the law. It wasn't necessarily that Said was a bad case, it just never was the law. But Peerless carves out an additional exception. It says the one general exception to this rule is where contractual rights have arisen. And I would submit to this court that you cannot have bad faith unless you had an underlying express or implied contract. And in this case, the Peerless carves out an exception. This very court has also said that we don't have to blindly adhere to We don't have to blindly adhere to Peerless because in the Roberts versus U.S. Fidelity and Guarantee case, this court said, look, this case is six and a half, in the Roberts case, the case was 10 years old. The court said, we need closure, we need finality, we need judicial resolution. If this court orders a remand, I want to talk about that. If this court orders...
Before you do, let's stay with that issue because that, to me, is the issue. When you... I know you argued what you just argued just now in your brief, and I didn't understand really why. When, if, in fact, you apply the Peerless Doctrine, Saeed was never the law, then Zappo's the law.
Your Honor, we tried it on an actual intent standard, a higher standard. How can Midwestern claim their prejudice if we have to go back and try it on a lower standard?
You're saying you met either standard.
We met either standard, Your Honor.
Zappo does not require intent, which SAD did.
That's correct. And we, Your Honor, I will say you, to you that they did not, Midwestern did not appeal the contractual issues in this case. So forevermore, for time immemorial, the law of this case is that Tony is not an arsonist and Tony did not materially misrepresent the policy. So why would you remand this case when the law of the case is that Tony is not an arsonist and Tony didn't materially misrepresent? And I will also say, just in human terms, Tony and Ruth Wagner ran what I would call a gauntlet. In James Fenimore Cooper's Last of the Mohicans, he talks about Indians with clubs armed on either side and they capture a white settler and that settler has to run to his freedom. Tony and Ruth Wagner went through a 13-month delay. They went through an 8-day jury trial. They took the clubbing, they took the beating, they took the innuendos, they took the character assassination. They ran the gauntlet. The jury unanimously said, you're vindicated, you're entitled to your freedom. Now the Court of Appeals says, blindly adhering to Peerless, even though it doesn't sound right, you got to go back and run the gauntlet of a lesser standard.
Well, let's step back a little bit from the trial. And the Zappo standard is reasonable justification. Now, Midwestern was their opinion that this was arson. You had wanted to comment on the facts. Is there any other, was there any other investigation going on by the fire department and that they came to the conclusion that this was Zappo's, this was arson, so that we could say that there was reasonable justification under the Zappo standard?
Tony Wagner never was investigated, questioned, or charged with arson. The fire department conducted no additional physical investigation. They originally said in their report that the fire was unknown causes. The only additional physical evidence they received was Midwestern's opinion that it was an incendiary fire, and they changed their report to say it was an incendiary fire.
And would you say then, counsel, that that is not a reasonable justification? At some point it becomes unreasonable to have failed to pay the claim, even though, you know, there wasn't a determination that was arson, but the standard is, did the insurer have a reasonable justification for failing to pay?
Justice, if you'll permit me, I'm going to weave that question I'm going to try to get some of these facts out so you understand. I'm sure you're sitting here thinking, why did the jury determine bad faith? It took them 13 months to deny this claim. The policy said they had 30 days from the proof of claim to make a decision. It took them 13 months, and you have to realize Tony and Ruth are out of business while they're debating this. On 11/25/91, now this is 2 months after they've received their cause and origin report, they have an internal memo. It says, we consider the insured, quote, innocent. At trial, they try to weasel out of that admission by saying, well, I didn't mean to say that the insured was innocent. What I meant to say was that the insured is presumed innocent. And then 350 days after this fire, they know that Tony is in severe financial straits, and they have an internal memo on Wizard Mail, which I don't understand. It says, Bill, this insured has severe financial problems. No decision to pay or not pay has been made. At that point, they're obviously taking advantage of the vulnerable position of our insured, and Zappo says that's one of the criteria for bad faith. When they denied this claim, they never even bothered to check their underwriting file to find out that there was no history of fraudulent claims, and Tony and Ruth were insured with this company for 10 years, and they were with the same agent for 30 years. And they didn't even acknowledge until the last day of trial that Tony suffered an out-of-pocket loss in this fire because his contents coverage wasn't adequate to pay his damages. So I think the jurors, whether you applied actual intent or you imply reasonable justification. They had ample evidence before them to make that determination, and I don't think they can claim prejudice.
Well, it is reasonable justification clearly proved if you prove actual intent.
I don't see how it could not be, and we had the burden of proof. And Judge, again, if we go back to retry, they didn't appeal the contract issue. So Tony is not an arsonist. Tony didn't materially misrepresent the policy. I don't see how they can screen prejudice at this point.
Are there some other issues in this case that are unresolved as well?
That's correct, Your Honor, and thank you for the lead-in. The next issue for this court, in my opinion, is one of first impression for this court, and it's the innocent spouse concept. I believe you're going to hear from Mr. Reeder that the judge, by directing a verdict on the innocent spouse, somehow prejudiced Midwestern's rights in this case. And I want to emphasize, when the judge directed a verdict on Ruth Wagner's contractual claim, he did not advise the jury he was doing that until the jury was instructed, and there was no objection from Midwestern as to the instruction or the timing of informing the jury. And the reason the judge had to grant a directed verdict is because their trial counsel got up in court and said, quote, "We do not propose to offer evidence that Mrs. Wagner was involved in the setting of this fire or that she participated actually in any way in the presentation of this claim, let alone committed any personal violation of the policy." In other words, their trial counsel got up and said, she's beyond reproach. There's no question that she's beyond reproach. We never even considered her as being involved. Then Midwestern seeks to exculpate her or disenfranchise her as the innocent spouse based on this policy, and I'm not sure you can read it, but it is in our supplement to our brief. Verlin Wagner is the named insured. Ruth Wagner clearly is a definitional insured because she's the spouse of an individual proprietor. Then they say, we will not pay except for resulting fire, loss caused by fraud or dishonest acts. Midwestern's counsel told the court that she didn't commit any fraud or dishonest acts, but they're trying to say that we exculpate her or from any coverage because we will not pay except for resulting fire. If you look at that language, it's clear on its face that that wasn't intended to apply to arson. Midwestern drafted this. You're not going to find this language. We don't believe. This is not a standard ISO policy. Midwestern drafted this language, and it's clearly designed to apply to things like embezzlement, inventory theft, and it has no bearing on this case. And I submit to this court, if that's what they're going to hang their hat on, it's not clear, it's ambiguous, and they're trying to disenfranchise their own insured. The last point I'd like to make in my case in chief is, the Court of Appeals took away prejudgment interest from us, and they said the reason we took away prejudgment interest is that the Wagner's counsel were not aggressive enough in trying to negotiate a settlement. This court in the Galladia case said a long time ago that when you're offered zero, any further negotiations are a vain act. And the record is replete in this case that at the final pretrial, Midwestern's position was unambiguous. It said, he said, quote, we are not offering you a thin dime. And the Wagners, my clients, knew what that meant, and I knew what that meant. And I submit to you that it should be the law of the state of Ohio that where you have an insured who has a contractual relationship with Midwestern and he complies with all the conditions preceding to the policy and he files a written proof of claim and they tell you we're not giving you one thin dime. If you win, in my opinion, you should be entitled to prejudgment interest. When they say zero, zero means zero.
Well, counsel, that, my goodness, that standard would be a tough one where an insurer had a reasonable justification, even though, it, like in this case, perhaps it could not be proved, arson could not be proved beyond a reasonable doubt on a criminal standard, but would should is that the standard, same standard as reasonable justification, in light of the fact here that there was evidence that the fire was incendiary, right?
Your Honor, this case couldn't have been proved. I don't care what's common, if you apply the standard of common sense, the standard of reasonable justification, the standard of actual intent, a criminal standard, it didn't make any difference. The dog would never get off the porch in this case. They had no change. There was so many contraindications of arson in this case that no one in their right mind could think this was an arson.
You're saying that although there was evidence that it was incendiary, that there were so many other factors that suggested that it was not, that therefore that was the incendiary finding was obviated. Is that what
that's,
you're saying?
That's exactly right, Your Honor.
But, I mean, it was there, so that's what you have to say, that there were so many other factors that it just was de minimis to just say it was incendiary.
Your Honor, there was no multiple points of origin. There was no use of accelerants.
Okay.
There was no changing of insurance coverages. He was totally candid in what he told him and what his pre-fire actions were.
Why do you concede it was incendiary then?
Yeah. Well, I'm not conceding anything, Your Honor.
Didn't only Midwest contend that it was incendiary?
They tried. The jury refused to accept it.
Well, it was an expert that said it.
Well, you say he's an expert.
Okay. You challenge his qualifications.
We challenge his investigation.
Okay.
He never even considered the possibility that Tony was innocent. He never even considered who did it.
This nevertheless would be a factor or some piece of paper in the hands of an insurer that they have to evaluate.
I would concede that.
Sure. There was no evidence that it was caused by anything other than incendiary. Is that right?
We had a retired fire chief from New York who investigated 100 arson fires come in and say he talked about the deviations from a proper investigation. His name was James McCormick. Tony Wagner, before he left the store, they had a moth problem in the bird seed, and he sprayed for a raid fly killer. And this gentleman testified that stuff is on a scale of 0 to 4 is a 4 in flammability, and he believes that an electrical spark from a refrigerator motor may have been an equal competing cause that caused a spark and caused the fire. And the literature is replete with that type of eventuality. And Tony told Midwestern that he had sprayed, and they never investigated. They never preserved the cans or anything. There, nothing to do that was consistent with his innocence.
In any event, what you're arguing with regard to prejudgment interest, haven't we said just that in Moskowitz and Galida, and even we changed the Bell standard in Moskowitz?
I just believe when an insured files a proof of claim, that is his demand to settle, and when they say go away, we're not paying, I don't know what the insured can do at that point. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Fitzgerald. Mr. Reeder.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to start out by focusing on the judgment that was entered on behalf of Mrs. Wagner in the case. I believe that judgment entered after oral argument was wrong on two counts. The first count is really very simple. Mrs. Wagner never made an insurance claim in this case. Never. I'm not grabbing at a pure minor technicality. She never made a claim. She never signed a proof.
Have you ever seen that, counsel, though, that when two parties qualify as an insured under the definitions of a policy, that both must file a claim? She's listed as an insured by definition.
She's not listed, but she's included by definition. It's not unusual to have a woman in her position not make a claim, because the fact is Mr. Wagner was the named insured and he was making a claim. And secondly, she really didn't own the business. If you read the first sentence of Wagner's brief, they'll tell you that Mr. Wagner is the one who owned this grocery store business. So there was nothing out untoward about the fact that she didn't make a claim.
But didn't the insurance policy itself state that if there are multiple individuals insured by the policy, that the first one named is the one that makes the claim?
No, that's a paraphrase, but I don't believe that that's an accurate statement of what the policy says or what it means in legal terms.
What do you interpret this meaning?
I believe that the policy had a number of provisions listed in the duties of an insurer that recite what an insured who's going to make a claim has to do. Probably the most fundamental thing they've got to do is sign a proof of loss, which is their sworn formalized claim. And she didn't do that here.
You don't think that it was sufficient that Mr. Wagner did that?
He didn't purport to make a claim on her behalf. If he had purported to do that, he would have said so in some document. He never did this.
You think that's required of him, that he had to make it, that it wasn't sufficient for him just to make it on his own behalf?
I don't believe that he was required to include her claim. He was entitled to make his own claim to the full extent of the damage to this store.
Okay, counsel. This case is Vernon Wagner et al. Who's the et al? Who sued here?
Well, both Mr. and Mrs. sued.
Okay, so she's not, she's still not making a claim at that point when she files her lawsuit?
The first time Midwestern knew that she was involved in the claim as a claimant was the day they received the lawsuit papers.
Okay.
We now have a situation where, because of a directed verdict on oral argument, Mrs. Wagner stands here, sits here today with $1.6 million.
Okay, did, what objections did you file to her being a party to the lawsuit?
There were no, well, there was affirmative defenses to her inclusion that said if Mr. Wagner's involvement in misrepresentations or arson could be established, then she was not entitled to collect.
Okay, but you didn't try to dismiss her because she couldn't properly be a claimant at that point?
Well, there wasn't a motion for summary judgment.
Okay, so
you're correct, but the point
and,
was
and if you had decided to settle this case, would you have written the check without obtaining a release from Mrs. Wagner?
I'm sure that as a party to a lawsuit, any logical lawyer would demand a release.
Was she an owner of the business?
She was. She owned a partial interest in the building. She did not own the grocery store.
Okay. So you wouldn't have written the check without obtaining her release?
Well, when you settle a lawsuit, you want to have all parties to that lawsuit sign the release. Yes, sir. That's exactly correct. Now, I'd also like to say that I believe she is not entitled to recover under the wording of the policy itself. The policy basically says that if the named insured, Mr. Wagner, committed a dishonest act such as arson, then he cannot and she cannot recover. The policies laid out in the briefs and so forth as exhibits. This is a case of first impression for this court, but many jurisdictions over the past 10 years have had to deal with policy language of the kind we're dealing with here. The insurance companies about 10 years ago, 15 years ago, changed the policy language because at that time the courts across the country were saying we're going to allow innocent spouses to recover because the unity of the marital unit makes no sense. And the courts were saying the only way we'll allow innocent spouses to be precluded is if you change the policy language. That's exactly what was done here in the case law. Suggest that it should be enforced. The Labraco decision, which is a Franklin County Court of Appeals case, is very, very close to this one. It interpreted policy language very similar to this and said that a wife's claim to a defense for a sexual misconduct intentional act situation was rightfully and properly excluded from the policy, even though her husband was the person who was guilty of the sexual misconduct. So the court recognized that by definitional phrasing, an insurance company is permitted to do that.
Is it your position that if you lose on the Zappos, which standard issue, that Mrs. Wagner's claim has to go back for retrial, or is her claim just lost because she never made a claim? What's your position?
My position is that Mrs. Wagner is not entitled to a judgment, period.
Ever?
Correct, on this record. That she never made a claim and therefore has no entitlement to relief, no entitlement to judgment, and that she is precluded by the policy language from recovery if Mr. Wagner committed a dishonest or fraudulent act.
But how do we find that? You see, she's not entitled to recover if he committed a fraudulent act.
Well, the problem is, it's an excellent question. The problem is that the judge chose to grant this on a motion on opening statements. Now, of course, now we know that he was found by the jury to be innocent of involvement in the fire. I understand that completely. Your question really goes to, was this harmless error? Because he's now found innocent and she got a directive. It's not harmless error, because harmless error goes to rulings on procedure, motions, admissibility of evidence. This is a situation where judgment was entered on Mrs. Wagner's behalf.
Judgment plus damages.
Yes, it's not harmless error when it's the judgment that's what is its issue. Harmless error applies to procedural rulings and things like that.
Would their recovery be the same recovery? In other words, judgment was entered in her favor, finding that Midwestern acted in bad faith with regard to her claim.
Correct.
Your point is she had no claim.
Right. How can you be in bad faith on a claim if they don't make one?
But she didn't file a proof of loss. And if she had any claim, it's really his claim or the business's claim.
Yes, there is duplication. I mean, he owned the business.
But did they get duplicate damages awarded by the jury, or were the damages the same damages that Mr. Wagner would have been entitled to?
There were verdict forms and interrogatories that gave them each different amounts of damage. But as I look at them, what really happened here is they got duplicate damages. They got $1 million for breach of contract out of the jury when the policy limit really was $197,000. Now, the Court of Appeals has corrected that, but the jury was clearly, it was mistaken, and the Court of Appeals has said that, but the jury was giving them duplicate damages for the same elements of damage.
I guess the question is, if we were inclined to reverse and reinstate the judgment of the trial court, doesn't her damages, don't they get enveloped into his, and isn't it one judgment?
No, that's not the way. The trial court judgment, the final judgment in this case, is about a 6 or 7 paragraph order, and it lays out that Mr. gets X contract damages, X bad faith, and X punitive. Then it says Mrs. gets boom, boom, boom. If you reinstate that trial verdict, Mrs. Wagner has her interest in an $800,000 punitive damage award when she never made a claim. There is no jurisdiction in this country that I'm aware of, no court that I'm aware of, that has ever said you can get a bad faith claim or punitive damages.
Well, these are,
for
you're
no
only
claim.
Talking about, because you said breach of contract damages. Breach of contract damages, was Mrs. Wagner awarded breach of contract damages and bad faith?
Yes. That's my recollection. She got breach of contract. She got, she got $500,000 breach of contract in the order from the trial court. She got $300,000 in bad faith money, separately identified, and they awarded her share of the punitive damage award of $800,000. It was separated out and segregated by amount.
At what point did you make an argument to the trial court that she has never filed a proper claim and therefore she's out of here, Judge? She's out of this lawsuit.
It was really made when the motion for directed verdict was made at opening statement.
And you explained that basis to the judge?
Well, the trial counsel focused mostly on the definition.
Well, I'm not interested in mostly. My question is, did you ever raise this issue in front of the judge? Did he have a chance to make a call on that?
Yes.
When?
When the opening statement was made, for starters, the answer was
she had no claim, and she was part of this lawsuit. Isn't it your obligation to tell the trial court, wait a minute, Judge, they can't make her part of this lawsuit. She didn't make a claim, and we are filing to delete her from any consideration in this lawsuit, because by law she didn't make a claim with us. You didn't do that.
But the defense was raised in the answer.
Just try and go along with my question. Did you do that?
No motion to dismiss or motion
then
for summary judgment was filed.
Then didn't you waive that issue when you didn't delete her from the lawsuit?
No, sir.
Why?
Because it was put in the answer. The trial counsel expressly incorporated the answer when he made his opening statement. It's in the record.
What did
he
say?
What
did you say? Did you say in your answer to the lawsuit that the Mrs. did not make a claim?
Denied that she made a claim.
And did you then raise in the answer that by not making a claim, she forfeited her right to go to trial? You didn't do that.
Truthfully, I don't remember.
Well,
but
you know you
but
didn't
denied
do it.
That she made a claim.
You
and that's in the answer.
It. So when you didn't do that, you waived that argument for all time.
It was not waived. If you deny something in your original answer, it's not waived, it's denied. And that's what occurred here. And this point was made when trial counsel argued the motion for directed verdict after opening arguments.
What did you argue?
But the trial counsel said, number one, that Mrs. was precluded from recovery if they could show that Mr. was guilty of arson.
He didn't say that she's precluded from recovery because she didn't make a claim.
But he argued that in the end, that he had incorporated the answer into his
counsel, I'm just stunned that you would stand here in the Supreme Court and devote all your time on this case to this issue and then tell us that when you argued, when the trial counsel argued this, he's arguing about her being excluded if you can prove that the husband was somehow involved, but specifically never raised this issue in front of the trial judge, and now, except by some obtuse reference to the judge is supposed to reread all the pleadings? I mean, do trial judges do that when they've got a motion at the front end of a trial to get out all the pleadings and read through them?
This was discussed and debated at the trial court level. A motion for summary or to dismiss was not filed. I'll readily say that. But it was raised in the answer. It was discussed because it was incorporated in counsel's opening statement, and it was asserted in the arguments relating to whether she should get a directed verdict. This was put before the trial court. The focus or the emphasis was on the contractual language on the part of both sides. But the judge was given the opportunity to deal with this at the trial court level, and this has been asserted at the Court of Appeals. This is not something that's dropped on the Supreme Court as a new item today.
No, because the Court of Appeals even ruled on, and they held that Midwestern had properly nullified the innocent spouse as declaring joint.
That's true. The Court of Appeals never really reached some of the questions that you're asking me because they
just went on the fact that there was joint coverage rather than several.
Now let me just
Counselor, maybe there's another explanation. The language in the judgment entry with regard to the $800,000 is exactly the same for both parties. Could it be that the trial judge was, because both parties were in fact parties in the suit, husband and wife, that the trial judge was just making sure that the $800,000 was a judgment that either or both collected, and it's the same $800,000?
Well, maybe he was making sure of that, and I appreciate that question because what it reminds me of is there was a prejudgment interest hearing and there was a punitive damage hearing in this case. And I was involved in the case at that point, and I can tell you that the record will show we were arguing you can't let Mrs. Wagner recover because she didn't make a claim. So now that I'm reminded at the end of the case and the punitive damage thing, this argument was made as well. If I may, I'd like to devote just 2 minutes to the bad faith issue. What I'm trying to say on that one is that the insurance company did have evidence that the fire was set. Not only did this outside investigator say that, but the Fostoria Fire Department, a public entity, had concluded that the fire was intentionally set by somebody. The insurance company had evidence of a lot of financial problems on the part of Mr. Wagner. That's in the record.
We've read that, and we know that maybe their incendiary nature and difficulties, and he was the last one there and
right.
All that. And you maybe had it, some expert, it looked like there was some experts on both sides that said it was and it wasn't. But the question becomes, the one I need you to answer is that the two different standards. Counsel's argument, your worthy opponent argues that a reasonable justification standard is a lower standard than the intent. And the jury here found, they heard all that. They heard that you thought he might have been an arsonist and that Mr. Wagner might have been involved in starting his fire. The jury heard that and nonetheless determined under the SAD standard that intent to, you know, what's the standard here? The insurer here refused to pay without lawful basis and knowingly, an intentional failure to determine whether there was any lawful basis for their refusal. So having hit that level, the jury having heard everything, how is it that you are harmed by the change in that standard to reasonable justification for not paying the claim?
Well, number one, it's a different standard. That's
right.
The word you used. I don't know that it's lower or higher. Number two, the question was raised about the impact of Peerless by Justice Douglas and whether the Zoppo case overruled Saeed. And I would remind the court that in the first paragraph of the syllabus of the Zoppo case, it says in express language that Saeed is overruled to the extent inconsistent herewith, and the companion to that case, Slater, is overruled point blank. So there was an overruling, and it seems that the Peerless decision applies. And I'd like to point out one final thing. Midwestern was prejudiced greatly on the bad faith issue in this trial, because what happened when the directed verdict was granted right at the beginning in favor of Mrs. Wagner. The rest of the trial, every 30 minutes, Mr. Fitzgerald did a beautiful job of dropping a bomb on the insurance company by arguing to the jury that Mrs. should have been paid day one and that it was bad faith for the insurance company not to have paid her. This is when no claim was made and when there was a legitimate issue relating to the innocent spouse language. In fact, in closing argument, Mr. Fitzgerald said, ladies and gentlemen, punish the insurance company because they didn't pay Mrs. Wagner right away. That in a circumstance when she didn't make a claim. It's an unfair bad faith trial to spend a week in trial allowing plaintiff's counsel to argue that the company should be punished for a ruling that was made at the very beginning that was off base and wrong. It infected and inflamed the entire trial to the prejudice of the insurance company. That's one more reason the case should be remanded or that judgment should be entered in favor of Midwestern on the bad faith claims as a matter of law.
Is that a proposition? Do you have a proposition of law that says that infected? I didn't see that.
I don't know that it was listed as a separate proposition of law, but the argument is certainly made in the brief submitted to the court.
Couldn't the jury just as easily have thought that the 13-month delay, given the language in the policy of 30 days, went to Mr. Wagner, and therefore that was the bad thing?
You're probably right. The jury could have done that, but it's speculation. We don't know because the jury interrogatories in this case did not define exactly why and wherefore the jury came to its
conclusion. Well, isn't it equal speculation to say that the bad faith verdict was motivated by Mrs. Wagner's position rather than Mr. Wagner's?
Well, but it's improper evidence and an improper ruling in the middle of the entire record. So to that extent, maybe it is some speculation, but it's there. It should not have been there, and it's persistent throughout the trial from day one to the very closing argument.
Thank you, Mr. Reed.
Thank you.
Mr. Fitzgerald, you've used your time, but you may say 30 seconds.
I share the Justice's concern about the failure of Ruth Wagner to file a proof of claim, because if you look at page 23 of our supplement, the policy reads, if more than one insured is named in this policy, the first one named shall act for all. Here again, Midwestern's using the policy not just as a shield and a sword. A shield to protect him, a sword to slice up Ruth's claim because she didn't file a proof of claim. If more than one insured is named in the policy, the first one named shall act for all. She didn't have to file a proof of claim by their own definition. Secondly, on the issue of directed verdict, listen to what the judge said. The court has directed a verdict for the plaintiff Ruth Wagner for the defendant's breach of contract, and Ruth Wagner is entitled to one half of damages, if any, that you might award in this case for the breach of the insurance contract. No objection to how the jury was instructed, no interrogatories to the jurors testing their bad faith verdict, saying, do you find the innocent spouse as to Ruth Wagner separate and distinct from our bad faith delay? Do you find the innocent spouse separate and distinct from bad faith failure to negotiate? Do you find innocent spouse separate and distinct from bad faith investigation, bad faith refusal to play? Midwestern didn't test the verdict. Now they want two bites at the apple. They didn't try a good lawsuit. They didn't defend a good lawsuit. They did not properly handle these people's claim. They want two bites at the apple. They want you to presume that they were prejudiced. They want to put the burden back on Tony and Ruth where it's always been, and they want a retrial. And we already know he's not an arsonist. And
I take it by that argument that you don't concede or will not accept that the $800,000 for each of them is duplicative?
No, Your Honor. In a bad faith claim, Tony's back in the store.
This is the contract claim.
We've accepted the remitter of $198,000 on the contract claim.
Let
me explain how the bad faith, the jurors could arrive at different numbers. Tony's in the store cleaning up the fire site. The meat's rotten. There's maggots in the meat. There's no air conditioning. It's 95 degrees. He has a heart attack. He becomes withdrawn. He doesn't talk to his family. He has loss of self-esteem. His bad faith damages are quantifiably different than Ruth's. Ruth's the shame. She's never filed a lawsuit. She's led a law-abiding life for 60 years. Yeah, they're different claims, and yeah, the jury treated him differently. They gave Tony $1 million. They gave her $300,000. I'm proud that the jurors distinguished between the two claims. They're not mutually fungible or mutually interchangeable. They were quantifiably different. and how the lawsuit affected him and how Midwestern's conduct affected him, affected their lives in markedly different fashion.
Does the language that you read indicating that, that one person can file for both insurance, does that answer the issue of the contract language, the policy language that, to which Mr. Reeder, that was his second argument, that why Mrs.
I think it's dispositive, Judge. It says, in black and white, it says, if more than one insured is named in this policy, the first one named shall act for all.
I had asked that question, and Mr. Reeder indicated that there were other parts of the policy that were contradictory, and that really, I was paraphrasing, but I thought I was reading exactly what you were reading.
Judge, I am not aware of the issue of her not filing proof of claim ever becoming an issue in the lawsuit. And I'm not aware of the trial judge ever being apprised that because she didn't file a proof of claim, somehow she's divested. And that's a shock to me.
You've used your time, Mr. Fitzgerald.
I thank you for the rebuttal time. Thank you.
The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.